Blog Talk Radio.
The Blog Talk Radio studios in the heart of Hudson County, folks. You know, it's always in Union City, New Jersey. Insider NJ proudly brings to you Politically Direct. And I am the professor, Fernando Uribe. I want to welcome you all here tonight, the 21st of November, the 2019. And folks, here is indeed flying by. Shout out to everybody I ran into down in Atlantic City during the League of Municipalities conference. What a great turnout. Great networking events, great cocktail hours, great open bars there by various organizations, certainly starting with Insider NJ at Cuba Libre, down at the Tropicana Hotel. What a great event it was on Tuesday night, folks. I mean, hundreds of people were there. And I have to tell you, I feel a little flattered. It was nice to just have random people come up to me and just say, hey, Fernando, great job with the show. Love your podcast. Keep up the good work. You know, guys, like that goes a long way, you know, in terms of just you know, making you feel good about what you're doing and the good that it is. So, again, to everyone I ran into during the municipalities down in Atlantic City, thank you so much again for the support of not just the podcast here with Insider NJ, but my other media projects as well. I love you all again, and it was great to run into you. And again, folks, I want to thank you for tuning in for more ever and however you may be doing so throughout Hudson County, throughout the Garden State, and, of course, throughout the good old U.S. of A. You can write the show's inbox, folks, at any time, publicly direct, nj@yahoo.com. If you have a suggestion or topic for a guest, hey, shoot me an email. I'd love to hear from you. Politically Direct NJ at yahoo.com. Feel free to follow the show on Instagram at Politically Direct NJ. Also, check out my own personal Instagram at Professor Fernando Uribe. A lot of different content there, some political, some humor, some sports, some politics. Everything that you love about life is right there on my Instagram, so check it out. And also hit me up on Twitter at Professor F. Uribe. And for all of you Facebook subscribers, please go to the official page for Politically Direct. Like it, of course. Share it on your walls and tell your friends to do the same. And I do want to hear from you tonight, folks, at some point. So call me toll-free, 818-572-8032. Once again, toll-free number tonight, 818-572-8032. And our toll-free number is brought to you by Insider NJ. Now, don't forget to check out Insider NJ, ladies and gentlemen, by going to www.insidernj.com for the best coverage of the political scene throughout the state of New Jersey. Nobody does it better. And I'll say it again, nobody does it better than Insider NJ, editor-in-chief Max Pizarro, down to our wonderful columnists, which include the Dean of Hudson County Journalism, Al Sullivan, along with Fred Snowflack, Jay Lillister, and many others. Alan Steinberg, I got to meet during the Insider Power Party. It was great. And folks, not just from only the journalism, but the power list that Insider NJ produces, whether it's the Millennials list, the LGBT power list, or even the annual one, the main power list stuff. That was released just shortly before the League of Municipalities convention. Hey, congrats to some of the guests on there. Some of them have been on the program. Some have yet to appear, but we'll get to them obviously in 2020. So again, folks, check it out, www.insidernj.com. Don't forget to follow them on Twitter and like them on Facebook. And again, nobody does politics better here in the NJ than Insider NJ. All right, folks, again, 818-572-8032, toll-free number tonight. Again, look forward to hearing from you at some point later tonight. We have a guest coming up in just a moment. But as a reminder, the opinions and views expressed tonight and every week here are mine and mine alone. They do not represent those of Insider NJ, the manager, the journalist, or the staff. Folks, just as a reminder, I can't say enough how thankful I am to my bosses at Insider NJ, starting off with the Graham family, specifically Mike Graham. Good to see you, Mike, at the conference there. I really appreciate the vote of confidence there, the kind words about the show. Obviously, Good to know that, joining forces with Insider NJ was the right decision. And all I try to do is just, you know, provide good content every week. And, you know, it's nice when your bosses can kind of like pat you on the back and say, hey, Fernando, keep up the good work. You're doing a good job. You know, it means something. You know, it may not mean all, you know, it may not mean something all the time to us, but, you know, especially in this business, when you get that sort of positive reinforcement, it's always a good thing. So again, shout out to him. Shout out to Pete Oneglia. I'm sure he's going to hate me for plugging him tonight here on the podcast. But again, he's a great boss, being the general manager of Insider. Probably the hardest working man, I think, in journalism, other than Max Pizarro, I think, in the state of New Jersey. I think these two guys just work like crazy hours. And, you know, but that's why Insider NJ is so successful. And that's why we're number one at what we do. So again, shout out to everybody down there. And again, folks, it got me thinking before, you know, I'm having a very interesting guest on in just a few moments here. It got me thinking about academia, because not only do I work in academia, but I also see what's happening with academia. And that's the subject of my first shot. Well, folks, I've talked about it on this program repeatedly, and I'm someone who, you know, I don't teach full-time at a four-year college university per se. You know, I'm very proud to be teaching at one of the most respected, if not the most respected, community college in the state of New Jersey, in Paramus at Burton Community College. Love it there. It's a great, you know, great faculty, I'm not going to lie. The boss, very good boss. Students, you know, they're engaged. But what I'm seeing in higher ed, I think not just in other schools and throughout New Jersey or the country, is we're just seeing sort of like this infestation of what liberalism does. And I've talked about on this program before, and I'll say it again, folks, it's hard not to sort of look at, you know, liberalism sort of sinking their teeth into something and not, you know, having it rot. And I think academia is probably the biggest example of that. I've talked about it on this program before. Now, I'm not someone that espouses my political views in the classroom. I know some professors do. I don't agree with that. I mean, I'm not going to tell them how to do their job. I mean, that's their business. But I don't believe in indoctrinating students. I believe in teaching, having a discussion, having a dialogue. I don't believe in brainwashing my students. I think a lot of my colleagues in academia do that. And that's a disservice to students. That's not what parents pay tens upon thousands of dollars every year to the school that they send their kids away to. And to have them brainwashed or indoctrinated by leftist professors, I just think is a disservice. And I look at a great website like such as campusreform.org, and it reminds me again about how toxic liberalism is, especially in higher education. And it just, there was a recent article by Eduardo Nerit, a good reporter there at Campus Reform, talking about, you know, students walking out of class and shutting down the streets in support of illegal immigrants in Washington. Now, apparently it was reported earlier this week, that students from Georgetown University, John Hopkins University, and George Washington University walked out of class on Monday and marched to raise awareness for DACA. Now, the Georgetown students, for example, marched through Georgetown and DuPont Circle with plans to shut down traffic. Now, the Supreme Court recently heard arguments for the DACA case. So I'm just going to give you sort of a brief run here about the article, folks. But hundreds of Washington, D.C. college students walked out of class to raise awareness for deferred action for childhood arrivals, otherwise known as DACA, ahead of the Supreme Court arguments that were heard recently on November 12th. Now, the Supreme Court is weighing the legality of President Trump's decision to terminate the program enacted by former President Barack Obama in 2012. Now, DACA, which was created through executive order, protects illegal immigrant children who were brought to the U.S. as minors. Many of these immigrants are now college-age students. Now, students started the protest by organizing at their respective campuses, which included Georgetown University, John Hopkins University, and George Washington University. But what's interesting, folks, is when you go on the website and you look at this reporter, who's very, very nice, very calm, he's trying to talk to some of the students that are protesting there, and they're walking, right? I mean, these are very impressionable young minds. And what was interesting is according to the Facebook event page, I mean, the Georgetown students were trying initially to shut down Key Bridge, which links Georgetown with Rosslyn, Virginia, right? I mean, stopping traffic is dangerous. You know, you don't know people trying to get to work. It might delay emergency vehicles. It's just not a smart thing to do. And, you know, obviously the students were escorted by the police for the entirety of the march. Now, students from all campuses later met at the Supreme Court, where they marched and chanted for hours. And one of the things, folks, that really bothers me about this activism is, you know, listen, I get it. You might not like the Supreme Court, you know, having to address this case. But the problem, though, is that you're sort of looking at what liberalism does in terms of the toxicity on our college campuses. I mean, at the specific ground, believe me, folks, it's not just something you saw this week. I mean, it happens all over the country. Okay, so in addition to like sort of like the DACA-related chants, right? Like there were protesters also chanting Black Lives Matter and other like anti-Trump and anti-immigration and customs enforcement chants.
right? Like some students you could hear in the video there, for example, saying ISIS work is to uphold white supremacy, to get rid of brown and black people and keep people of European descendancy in power. And you know, one of the interesting things about this is when you look at these marchers, right? It almost boggles my mind when I talk to college students like this, who are so sort of, and this product, again, folks, years of indoctrination, not just at the college level, but we're seeing it at the high school and elementary school level, where we're seeing teachers and educators sort of bringing their politics into the classroom. And this is dangerous. And this is something, again, as someone who works in higher education, right, I'm someone, again, I don't bring my views into the classroom at all. I get it. We live in a very techno world. It's not hard for my students to sort of Google me, look me up on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram, and you can kind of get a sense of where I lean ideologically. But I don't do that in the classroom. I'm also very careful about what I post on social media. But the bottom line, though, folks, is what I'm seeing, though, is this continuing toxicity by liberal professors on our college campuses, and it's dangerous. It's dangerous. It's just setting a bad example. And again, look no further than campusreform.org. Look at that demonstration from Monday and many others across the country. We're seeing students taking to the streets. And it's fine. They can assemble peacefully. I don't have an issue with that. But a lot of sort of the narratives that they're sort of pushing are as a result of their professors and their teachers who are sort of, you know, brainwashing them with leftist ideology. And that, folks, again, that's not teaching. Okay? That's indoctrination. Again, if for some of my colleagues in academia, if you feel good at night going to sleep and knowing that you're doing that, that's your business. But that's not what I do. And I think, unfortunately, as I said before, I mean, it's gotten to the point where, like, liberalism is so entrenched within higher ed that it's impossible to extract it, right? I mean, I'm not a medical doctor, but what I can tell you is that with anything, when you're trying to cut out a cancer, I mean, you can try to cut out as much as you can, and hopefully you're successful and you remove it down to the root. That's not easy in academia. You know, liberalism has really sunk their teeth into it for the last 30 years, and it's really hard. I'm glad a lot of students are looking past it. But if you look at what happened on Monday in Georgetown, you can see a lot of these students, what they're doing is because of the professors themselves. And that, folks, is my first shot here on Politically Direct. 818-572-8032. Again, 818-572-8032. Look forward to hearing from you tonight, folks. But it is 9:12 on the East Coast. And it's my pleasure to welcome to the program at this time, for the very first time, someone who I'm a very big fan of, someone I was very interested in having on the program here. She is a professor of law at the Rutgers Law School, my alma mater, Rutgers University. She is also the director, folks, of a very outstanding and interesting organization on campus. It is the Rutgers Center for Security, Race, and Rights. Please welcome to the show tonight, Ms. Sahar Aziz here on Politically Direct. Professor, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. It's good to have you on here. How's your semester been so far?
It's been busy, as usual, but thanks for inviting me, and I look forward to our conversation today.
Absolutely. I've been looking forward to it. Again, as a Rutgers alumnus, you know, someone who's very, bleeds scarlet red through and through, you know, did my undergrad work in New Brunswick, did all my graduate degrees at Newark, and, it's something interesting, I look at the times we live in politically, and I certainly want to get to a lot of the extensive work you did, certainly want to talk about the center. I sort of want to start off with this. You know, Professor, I would argue that it seems like we're living in a very sort of interesting time of tribalism. And it seems that it has really encompassed our political climate for some time. And one of the things I've espoused on this program is this, I would argue, precedes the current president. I think for some time now in America, here in the United States, we've been seeing this tribalism really surface, not just in academia, in pop culture, I think in government to some extent, in terms of the war between the parties and ideology. How do you see it today?
Well, I think that what we're seeing today is depolarization of American society that is triggered by various factors, some of which have been building up for years, if not decades, and some of which are directly related to who occupies the White House and the type of rhetoric, polarizing rhetoric that's coming out of the White House. I mean, the United States has always had a challenge that has been both its strength but also its weakness, which is it's a highly diverse society. And with that can risk balkanization, or that can risk, you know, if you want to call it tribalism or group-based conflicts based on identity or based on family origin or based on heritage. And so in many ways, the United States is structured to always be at risk of this type of polarization, whether not necessarily along a dichotomous line, but probably multipolar lines. And unfortunately, what's happening out of the White House, in my opinion, the type of rhetoric that we hear from the president is worsening that polarization, and then also aggravating it is what we're seeing on social media with these bots and these companies, some of which are hosted by foreign governments, that are operated by foreign governments, that's manipulating social media to provide the type of, if you want to call it fake news or accurate news in some cases, to cause people to become more and more emotional, more and more influenced by propaganda as opposed to facts. And that's dividing a country that's, I said, again, already vulnerable to being polarized. The other dynamic, I think, contributing to polarization is the segregation of our society, the increasing segregation of our society along class and race lines. I mean, they, class and race overlap. But the less that the diverse communities interact with each other in real life, in their daily life, at school, at work, you know, in their towns, in their neighborhoods, the easier it is to use fear to cause them to distrust people that are different from them. So I think that's something else that is contributing to the existing polarization across the country, and then even within states, within cities.
Well, excuse me, Roger. Listen, that's very well said. There's a lot to unpackage there. And I would argue, listen, a lot of your points, you know, I'm on board with. The idea that we're seeing, again, as you referred to, you know, our diverse really is one of our greatest strengths. It's also one of the things that really has been very polarizing as well. And, you know, we looked at your website. Again, folks can check out www.csrr.rutgers.edu. That's the official website for the Rutgers Center for Security, Race, and Rights. And I like Paige. I follow it on Facebook. I look at all the posts. And there's always a lot of interesting material on there. What ultimately led to the creation for the center, and you as its director, what have been some of the accomplishments in recent years? I mean, obviously, you know, I'm looking at the home button, obviously, why the organization exists. You know, it's, folks, if you're not, best to check out the website. It's really, really informative, and it's, you know, really, really good material on there. But what led to the creation for our audience that maybe is hearing about the center for the very first time, Professor? What led to its creation, and quite frankly, since its creation, what impact have you seen that it's been able to accomplish?
Well, the center is in many ways a culmination of work that I've been conducting over the past almost 20 years alongside other lawyers and advocates and community members, having to address the unfortunate rise in bigotry and prejudice against Muslim, Arab, and South Asian communities that has been directly correlated, if not outright caused by the September 11th attacks aftermath. So as many of us know, this was the worst terrorist attack on U.S. soil. And because it was committed by 19 criminals who self-identified as Muslims, many Americans began to associate, or whatever suspicions they had pre-existing of associating Islam and Muslims with violence and terrorism got confirmed, were confirmed in their minds. And we started to see and experience and live in our daily lives a collective punishment. And it didn't get better with time. It actually kept getting worse and has become, sadly, an entrenched part of race politics in the United States. And we see it, and we've seen it with, again, the current president, and particularly during his campaign and the very first executive order that he issued a few days after he's inaugurated, was to exclude tens of millions of people from Muslim-majority countries, and it was no coincidence that they were Muslim-majority countries. And his administration touted it as a national security measure, reaffirming the association that Muslims are a threat to national security. So the center aims to engage in three, main areas. One is the intersection of race and religion. So looking at the way in which religious freedom may not be as expansive as we were taught in schools, and looking at why some people have religious freedom and some have either no religious freedom or much less religious freedom than we assume that they do, and looking at that intersection between race and religion. The second is looking at what we call criminalizing Muslim identity, which is stating it bluntly, as opposed to through some euphemism of national security and civil rights, because effectively what's happened is the national security laws and policies have been selectively enforced against Muslim communities, and we see that with the rise, for example, of right-wing extremism and the way that the government and even the public doesn't view it through the same lens as it does if it were a Muslim. And then the third is transnational rights and security, which is looking at what happens abroad in Muslim-majority countries, how that affects what happens to those communities in the U.S., the diasporic communities in the U.S. And that's always been the case, particularly for immigrant communities, is whether you're looking at Italian-Americans, Jewish-Americans, Catholic-Americans, Irish-Americans. I mean, you pick your immigrant group, frequently the way that they're stereotyped in the United States is associated with foreign relations between the U.S. and their countries of origin or regions of origin. So in many ways, that's not new. But because there has been a rise in terrorist violence in the Middle East, primarily because of the U.S. occupation in Iraq and the unleashing of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which then merged into ISIS. So although most people who die from these terrorist actions are Muslims, the Western world has come to then associate Muslims again with terrorism. So ultimately, this center is trying to unpack all of that through public education, academic research, and advocacy. And thus far, we've had a very robust lecture series. Last year, it was called the Islamophobia Lecture Series. This year, it's called The Color of Religion. And again, you can find all of that under csrr.rutgers.edu. And we post all of our lectures on our YouTube channel, which you can access through the website. And your viewers will notice that most of it is by very highly accomplished experts who have published books on these topics, because I think that's something else that the center is trying to do is, if we're going to talk about these topics, we need to talk about it from an informed perspective, by people who have studied the issues deeply and who have a wealth of information, rather than by pundits or political operatives or people who are just bigots and want to justify further discrimination against communities, even if it's under the auspices of national security. So ultimately, in a nutshell, this center is aimed to educate and to counter a lot of the misinformation that's out there that is causing very real harms and very tangible harms to the civil rights of people who are self-identified or are presumed to be Muslim, Arab, and South Asian.
Wow, that's a lot there. If you just joined us right now, it is 925 on the East Coast here on Blog Talk Radio. It's my honor to have with me here Rutgers University School of Law professor and the director of the Rutgers Center for Security, Race, and Rights here tonight on Politically Direct, the great Sahar Aziz here on the program. Sorry, listen, you mentioned obviously in the first three themes that, the center is predicated on, obviously talking about, the intersection of race and religion. Religion is certainly a very polarizing issue. It's a very controversial topic, whether we're talking about it politically or anything else. And, it's something that I talked about earlier in the year, and I want to get your thoughts on this. I really wanted to get a sense of, if you've heard this sort of rhetoric, what normally is the response. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with a young lady, Maya. Elizabeth Meyer was the founder of the New Jersey Women's March. Are you familiar with her by any chance?
No, I'm not.
Okay. Well, the reason I bring her up is
But you can tell me about it. Give me a quick synopsis.
Sure. Well, I mean, certainly. Listen, Ms. Meyer was a housewife that was very dissatisfied after the election results of November 2016, and she started mobilizing and organizing women throughout North Jersey, and really it mobilized throughout the state, and it was sort of under the umbrella of the National Women's March. Obviously, we know that during nomination weekend, when the 45th president took the oath on January 20th, the very next day, D.C. and I knew this since I was there, and I was there for the inauguration. I was there the very next day in D.C. as I was trying to get some sightseeing done. Obviously, the Women's March took over D.C. as it did in various other cities in the country. Well, here in New Jersey, the Women's March.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
And Ms. Meyer had organized the march here. And, someone who I had on this program before, and I think she would identify as someone who's like sort of middle of the road, I voted Democrat for sure, but someone who's very middle of the road. And I had brought to her attention that at the national level, the Women's March, there were some polarizing figures that were leading the march or being one of the louder voices. And I brought to her attention the idea of, Linda Farsour, for example, being one of the more vocal leaders and mobilizers of the Women's March at the national level. And certainly, I asked her, I'm like, what does that do to women's marches in individual states? And I said to Ms. Meyer, I said, listen, and this might get in trouble, but I'm going to say it as carefully as I can because I think it has some validity to it. As someone like myself, Sahar, who is not the most fanatical Catholic, I'm Hispanic, predominant Christianity and Catholicism is sort of the, by and large, the overwhelming faith of practice in Latin America. But I'm not the greatest Catholic in the world, but I'm Christian. I believe in Christ. I respect all religions. I'm not someone that is, sort of blasphemous about it. But I said to her, I said, Elizabeth, for someone like me, it's kind of hard to take someone like Linda Sarsour seriously when she's going to sit there and lecture me, a man, about the toxicity of the patriarchy and about the toxicity of masculinity, when she's out there wearing a hijab and lecturing me about the toxicity of the United States, where there's perhaps no more an oppressive institution on the planet, Sahar, than Islam, that oppresses women and homosexuality openly in a lot of countries in the Middle East. I, as a guy, regular person, found it hard to look at Linda Sarsour seriously. And I said, I don't want her lecturing me about oppression when she certainly has a lot better here than she would back home, and as well as some of her family in Middle Eastern countries. And for someone to lecture me about the toxicity of the patriarchy when she is wearing a hijab, I think is insulting to me, Sahar. And I don't take someone like that seriously. I don't disagree with some of the merits of the Women's March. I think there are some legitimate points that have to be addressed about inequity in pay. I think certainly some reproductive rights, I think, are under attack. I can get behind all of that stuff. But I just can't take someone seriously like Linda Sarsour lecturing me while it's plainly obvious that the most oppressive institution on the planet is Islam. It's not even close in terms of what it does to women and how it criminalizes homosexuality.
Okay.
I find it odd.
So I think so I think that statement is a really offensive statement to assume that
okay.
An entire religion is the most patriarchal and sexist religion. I mean, it's the equivalent of saying that about any faith. Religions are comprised of, Islam has 1.5 billion followers and Christianity has about the same, if not a little bit more, across the world. And as we know, religions are practiced in different countries, in different regions, based on the context. A lot of it has to do with the class of the followers in terms of and their education levels, their history, their culture. So I think the first thing we have to start out with is that we shouldn't say about any religion that it is the most sexist or the most patriarchal. I think it's more trying to figure out where the intersection of culture and religion and history and politics can produce patriarchal practices. And within those very same cultures, those very same countries, you can also see non-patriarchal practices. So, for example, there are many people that are outside the United States who are dumbfounded that we've never had a female president. And, you know, to presume that simply because we haven't had a female president that, you know, our entire culture and whatever underlying Protestant Christian faith we have, that our Christian religion that informs American culture, is axiomatically, categorically patriarchal, I don't think would be accurate. I mean, we have a lot of very highly educated female leaders and many things that are pro-women in the U.S., and we also have things that are misogynist and patriarchal in the U.S. So I think we have to at least start the conversation by rejecting any kind of categorical vilification of an entire faith. And that's frankly exactly why we created the center, is because, you know, these types of ideas, unfortunately, have become mainstreamed. And they usually tend to, I mean, I don't know how many Muslim women you know, but, and I don't know how many Muslim women wearing a hijab you know, but I think if you knew a large number, you would discover that the hijab doesn't, it is a piece of cloth. And especially within the American paradigm, it's really about choice. And there are many women, including in the Muslim world, where it's not legally required to wear the hijab, who are highly educated, more educated than their female counterparts in the Western world, who are highly successful, who have risen in politics. I mean, Pakistan's had a female prime minister. Bangladesh has had a female prime minister. And there, I think, Malaysia. So there are many Muslim-majority countries that have women leaders of the state. And then there are those who haven't, you know, similar to the U.S. We've never had a female president. We've never even had a female vice president. But again, because we live here and we understand the context, we understand how complicated that is, that does say something about America, but it doesn't say everything about America vis-a-vis gender. So I think that's one thing. The other thing is, let's talk about the hijab, because unfortunately it's become politicized, and in the obsession with the hijab vis-a-vis Muslim women's rights is itself misogynist. And whether it's by, you know, highly conservative Muslims who do want to control women's lives and women's bodies, and there are Christians who do the same thing, and there are Jews who do the same thing, and there are all sorts of religions who have men who are highly misogynist. But the problem with the obsession with the hijab is that it's the same story of obsessing about the body of a woman. So whether you're obsessing about her uterus vis-a-vis abortion debates, or you're obsessing about her vagina vis-a-vis, you know, sex and whether she can have sex or can't have sex, or whether you're obsessing about her hair or her clothes, you know, does she look like a loose slut because of what she's wearing, or is she oppressed because she's covering? I mean, all of these discussions that obsess and center around the woman's body, that in itself is misogynist, as opposed to looking at kind of more substantive issues of, are we providing equal access to education, equal access to quality health care, equal access to security, right? Not allowing women or not having women experience violence at rates that are different than men. Those types of substantive rights are much more important than what a woman is wearing. And to the extent that hijab is relevant, I think it should be only within the context of coercion or lack thereof, right? Making sure that it is a free choice. But I can tell you, as someone who travels the Middle East frequently, and I'm originally from Egypt and I go frequently, there are many women in my family and in my friends who wear the hijab freely. And then there are many women who don't. And they get along and they're friends because it's seen as a personal choice. And, you know, it really is the equivalent. I always try to tell people in the United States who are not Muslim and who may not have a lot of Muslim friends, but I see it to a large extent. Do you want to wear jeans or do you want to wear a skirt? Do you want to wear a dress or do you want to wear shorts? I mean, it's none of our business. In my opinion, it's the woman has to come to those terms by herself. And of course, her family is going to influence her. Her friends are going to influence her, just like we're all influenced by the people in our lives. I think we need to normalize the hijab, because we've got in New Jersey, you know, over 3% of New Jersey's population is Muslim. And so some of, you know, in Rutgers, Newark, there are many women who wear the hijab. I don't, and I don't judge them for it. And if they judge me, then I disregard it, because the principle is individual liberty.
I'm sorry, good job. And I just want to be clear, because, again, I don't want something to take out of context. I mean, I'm simply – the example I referenced with Linda Sarsour, for example, is not so much the idea of the hijab. I mean, my major grief is just the idea of, you know, whether it's someone like her or someone that's viewed as someone who's openly radical. And let's be honest. I mean, we're adults. Let's talk real. You know, we're academics, both of us, but let's talk real. I mean, there's certainly a difference between someone who is a more moderate founder of Women's March in New Jersey as opposed to someone like Linda Sarsour, who's openly radical, and we know about some of her radical ties. But that's not even my point. My point is just when I hear her talk, you know, openly or sort of in a way that sounds like she's lecturing me, forget about what she's wearing. I just look at it simply from the point of you're going to lecture me about living here. And I get it. There's still inequities that women face. There's no question. But as opposed to back in our homeland, where many countries in the Middle East operate under the doctrine of Sharia law, where let's be honest, okay, I'm not a constitutional law professor. I'm a political scientist. Now, again, I don't have sort of the qualification to talk about law per se, but I know enough, professor, that let's be very honest, the idea of Sharia law as opposed to what, you know, is here in terms of our legal document, which I tell my students all the time is the greatest legal document in the history of mankind, our Constitution. But the idea that someone like Linda Sarsour is going to lecture me here about whatever she wants to lecture me about, that's fine. That's her right to do that. But don't come at me when we all know that in many Middle Eastern countries, the idea of what Sharia law is, I mean, professor, come on. Like, let's be real here.
Okay,
like,
well, you know, let's disconnect. There's a couple things that you're saying. So first is you're imposing on her a position that I don't think is appropriate, which is simply because she happens to be a Muslim and she's an American, right? She's a U.S. citizen, mm-hmm. that suddenly she has to account for or explain or represent over hundreds of millions of Muslims, 1.5 globally. It's like mm-hmm. saying that whatever your ethnic background is or national origin is, that you suddenly are responsible for whatever problems there may be in that country of origin. So I don't think that's part of the problem with, this is a form of Islamophobia where you expect one person who happens to have a particular national origin or a particular religion to then be responsible, to have to explain away, to have to not even have the right to engage in the U.S. debate, even though this is a U.S. citizen whose life is here, mm-hmm. who's addressing issues mm-hmm. here because she lives here, her kids live here. She, you know, her parents may have immigrated, but she lives here mm-hmm. now. And this isn't, I mean, I'm not interested in defending a particular individual or not. That person could have been me,
sure.
or it could have been some other Muslim woman, or it could have been an Irish American or an Italian American or a Senegalese American. The point is, once people immigrate here and settle here and get citizenship and they live here, this is their home country. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's fair for us to hold them responsible for whatever may be happening abroad. So that's the first point. The second point is, most people say Sharia law and don't really understand what it is. So the first thing is, there are really only two countries in the world where Sharia is the law of the land, and that is Iran and Saudi Arabia. The rest of the countries that are Muslim majority, they're secular countries, they're secular states, but they're Muslim majority. And in many of those countries, the separation between religion is an important part of public life. Okay. Now, legally speaking, most of them have secular laws that are actually colonial, from the colonial era. So it'll be French law, or it'll be British law, or it'll be Dutch law that is still there because it was essentially imposed on them by the colonial countries. But then they will have varying degrees of, provisions either in their constitutions or their laws, usually with regard to family law, which will say that Sharia is either informs it or is binding on it. Okay. But then you have to ask yourself, what is Sharia law? Because it's become this bad word in the U.S. Very intentionally and by design by the right wing, right? By the Breitbarts, by the Stephen Bannons, by the Steve Millers, by the Donald Trumps. I mean, it's not a secret. They're very proud of it.
But we have to hold on a minute because if
you say canon law or you say halakha law, that's not necessary. You have to understand what it is. So Sharia law, let me just explain what Sharia law is, okay? It's a jurisprudence. Mm-hmm. It's where you have multiple sources. You have the Quran, you have Hadith, which are the sayings of the Prophet, and then you have different jurisprudential models of consensus and logical reasoning and analogous reasoning, and it's essentially a jurisprudential system, right? That was the indigenous legal system in those parts of the world, and they produce very different outcomes. You know, you have different schools of thought. There are some countries where they say a woman can divorce. There are other countries say, no, only the man can divorce and she can divorce, but under certain circumstances. There are others who, I mean, it's a very complicated system, and you're talking about over 20 countries. So I think what we first have to do is we have to first separate, right, the U.S. Americans, U.S. citizens who happen to be Muslim, mm-hmm. from what's happening in 20-plus countries. And then we have to understand each country and its context, and because it's really complicated. Australia is not the same as Britain, is not the same as the United States, even, and it's not the same as Canada, even though all three are primarily Christian and are English-speaking.
Oh, listen, that's fair. And the reason I wanted to bring this up to you, because, and I know you just referenced, for example, the terminology that's being used by the right wing. Again, Professor, I mean, someone like Bill Maher, I think we all know is not right wing whatsoever. He is as devoted a liberal as there is. He's got a very strong voice, and believe
but
it or not,
but he's very Islamophobic, and he's open about that. He's okay with that, but you know, he's very anti-Muslim.
You can be left wing
and be anti-Muslim.
Well, okay. Well, let's look at it this way. I mean, is he viewed as, I mean, I don't think he would ever come out and say he's an Islamophobe, but is he viewed that way, do you think, in the mainstream media?
Absolutely. He's viewed that way by the vast majority, particularly on that issue. On other issues, he would probably align more with progressive values, but he definitely has an axe to grind with Islam, which we have yet to figure out why.
That's a fair observation. Folks, again, if you just joined us right now, it's 9:40 here on the East Coast, and joining me here tonight, distinguished law professor from Rutgers University and also the director of the Center of Security, Race, and Rights at Rutgers University in Newark, the great Sahara Aziz, joining us here tonight on Politically Direct. Professor, we'll get back to that in a moment, and I really want to sort of get the juices flowing here when it says do some critical thinking here today, and I appreciate your viewpoint. When we talk about, I sort of unpackage, not so much also religion, I also sort of want to look at the other themes that are predicated on within the organization. When we talk about currently what's going on in the country, Professor, as it pertains to really immigration, and I referenced something during my opening monologue about students from Georgetown University and Johns Hopkins, and also I believe I'm just trying to look at my notes here. There was like three local schools in the Washington, D.C. area. Students have been mobilizing to voice their opinions about what's going on with DACA. So the Supreme Court heard legal arguments late last week. According to most sources, a decision probably will not be rendered by the Supreme Court until sometime in the spring. So it'll be some months until DACA is decided. Perhaps, who knows, maybe they'll just kick it back down to the states. We don't know. We'll find out. I alluded to this during my opening monologue, and I know that you also work in academia, Professor. And I've been talking about this not just on this podcast, but I also do a local TV show here in Hudson County on a regular basis. And, you know, I'm an educator too. And one of the things I talked about during my monologue, I don't work at a four-year university. I work at one of the more respected community colleges in the state. And, you know, I take my job seriously, as do you. And as someone who works in higher ed, you know, I firmly believe that teaching is the goal, and that should be our goal. But I just don't see that happening a lot on our college campuses, Professor. I see a lot of indoctrination and brainwashing, and it's scary. And I know sometimes I've been accused of being hyperbolic on my show when it comes to reference examples of very liberal and leftist professors. But it seems to be toxifying higher ed, Professor. It really is. And not just New Jersey. I've seen it at Rutgers and New Brunswick, my alma mater. It pains me when I see it. It pains me when I see it on other campuses. And I don't know if it's a right, left thing. It just seems that that's not teaching today. I'm simply calling it indoctrination and brainwashing. And it's not just happening on our campuses. It's starting as young as down in the high school level and the middle school level. And I just think it's these type of educators, these few bad apples, I guess, unfortunately, but they're growing in numbers, that just seem to be ruining it for reputable, credible ones like you and I, that just go and teach and want to be, you know, helpful to our students. But it just seems like there's a certain aspect of liberalism that's toxifying our college campuses. And I understand, listen, there's a lot of things I can dissect about conservative politics that I don't like. So I'm fair and I'm very objective about it. But it just seems like there's just, God, it just seems like liberalism is toxifying our campuses. And it's getting to the point, Professor, where it's scary, where we see demonstrations, where we see just sort of shutdown of like free speech, where the idea of just like, if it's not a liberal point of view, it's being shut down on college campuses. And I'm sorry, that's not what higher ed is. I just want to get your thoughts on that tonight.
So first is, there's no such thing as neutrality. It doesn't exist. Everything has slant or, well, no, but hold on, a particular slant or a particular bias. And what we do, at least in law schools, is we teach students how to see all of the different perspectives and how to critically think and analyze and understand which side, or of the, it could be two sides or multiple sides, has the proof, right, has the evidence to actually support that perspective or that argument. But I don't mm-hmm. think it's possible to have a neutral, fully impartial context in the classroom, nor do I think we should, because that's not the way the world works. I mean, the world functions around power and wealth and influence. And I mean, there are multiple factors that produce, you know, the world that we live in that's very context specific. So I don't think we can get around that. And I think with every country, and then even within each country, there are certainly going to be certain norms and themes and values that will predominate. So, for example, you know, this is not a communist country, and so we are not going to have communist values within our education system. But it is a liberal country.
Oh,
it's an individualistic
country. Professor, hold on. All due respect, Professor. The idea, you're right, that it's not a communist country. But the idea is that there are very liberal professors on this camp, in this country, that are devoted communists or openly communists, and are teaching, you know, on college campuses in this country. I mean, that's very real. Like, that's not some scare tactic by the right.
No,
that's not hyperbole.
No, I understand.
It's scary.
I'm talking about the predominant educational system. Right? I'm not talking about individual professors, because ideally every student has enough professors that they eventually develop their own ideology, their own belief system, their own, and it changes over time. There's a saying that when I was in graduate school, I had an international relations professor who said to us, if you're under 30 and you're not liberal, you don't have a heart. And if you're over 30 and you're liberal, you don't have a brain. And yeah.
Churchill said that.
Churchill? Okay, so he was repeating Churchill's quote.
Mm-hmm.
And so people evolve. I'm not saying I necessarily agree with that saying, but we do all evolve from high school to college to in our 20s, our 30s, our 40s as we get older. And so it shouldn't matter whether a particular student has a particular professor who, under academic freedom norms, could say, yeah, I have decided that I believe in communism, or I believe in capitalism, or I'm a neoliberal capitalist, or I'm a socialist. I mean, but the professor can have those views, but usually the materials and the themes and the predominant education system is going to be heavily shaped by that country's norms and values. And so here, it's heavily influenced by liberalism. And that doesn't mean that everybody is a formal liberal, and nor should they be, because sure. The other theme that underpins our education system is free thinking, right? And being able to say, yeah, I don't want to be a liberal. I don't. I want to be a socialist, and not go to jail for that, and not lose your job necessarily for that. So I think we just need to think about what's the role of a professor. And in my opinion, is it's not necessarily to pretend like the professor is some robot who has no opinions, no views, no positions. That wouldn't be a very thoughtful person. We all think and come to conclusions, which can evolve over time. But it's more to expose the students to how do you examine and analyze these different positions, and to make sure that whatever information they read and whatever information they rely on is actually is credible, right? It's not propaganda. It's based on facts. It's based on real events. And then they've got to analyze, okay, how can we examine this? How can we, how do we juxtapose this against the historical context, et cetera? So, but yes, American academia has liberal leanings because America is a liberal country. I mean, it's a liberal is in the political science term, right? Not in the
sure.
political partisan term. But this is a
sure.
country that was based on liberalism. I mean, liberty, yeah, it comes from liberalism. It's a highly individualistic society. You know, Hobbes and Locke and all of these philosophers that are the foundational ideology undermining the Constitution and our legal system. So I think the question is, how do we create, what's the challenge these days is because of the polarization within the country and because of, unfortunately, more and more propaganda-based information on all sides, and less civil, informed, facts-based discussions and debates. It's making it where universities are put in a really tough spot where either they shut down completely and don't have debate because they don't want controversy, they don't want anyone to get upset, so then it becomes this sterile place that is not a place of intellectual learning and dynamism, or it's only one side, right? But even if you bring whoever you bring, the other side does have a right to protest, not disruptively. But if they want to have a protest, mm-hmm. they can have a protest. If some group wants to bring a speaker, let them bring the speaker. So it's really about creating that space where people can express their views and can debate their views in a civil way. But it is a tough time right now for universities. I mean, I would not want to be an administrator. It's very, very difficult because things are so polarized and students are becoming socialized to yell and scream and fight and not sit down and actually listen.
No, listen, you're right about that. Amen to that, Professor, because I'm with you. I do not envy any administrator right now in terms of what sort of comes across your desk in terms of any potential speakers or curriculum that is put forth. And the reason I bring this up as a topic is because I teach in the social sciences. So probably, I'm a history professor, but, I've taught political science courses, certainly because of my degrees, and I've taught, sociology and criminal justice. So it's something I'm very invested in. I find it as something that is concerning. And the example you brought up, obviously, law school is very different. Certainly friends of mine that have gone to law school have certainly told me how demanding it is. I appreciate that breakdown for me tonight and for our audience, because again, it's important to sort of, articulate here the challenges that we face in academia. Certainly I think the ones that you face are different than mine. I think that we both work hard at it, but again, as you pointed out before, it's a very challenging time. It's a very challenging time in terms of having a dialogue. And I just feel we're losing that, Sahar, the ability to have a conversation. And I think it's become so challenging. And I actually used an example with my students a couple of weeks ago in my history course. And I said, listen, I don't want to sound apocalyptic. I don't want to sound hyperbolic here. But I'm really worried about next year. Because I think what we've been seeing for some time, and whether social media is an accomplice in this, Professor, or it's just the climate we're living in for some time. I'm really worried. I'm worried about people at Thanksgiving next week during Thanksgiving dinner and Christmas dinner. I can't imagine families in this country how challenging it's going to be to be able to sit down and avoid talking politics at dinner tables all across this country. And I think it's getting progressively worse. I think going into 2020, it's going to get ugly. And I hope I'm wrong. And again, I don't want to sound like I'm predicting the end of the world, but I just have a feeling it's going to get really ugly next year to the point where it's going to – if it's already divisive, it's going to become even more divisive next year. What are your thoughts?
I think the most important thing is that we structure society in ways where people engage more. I think the more isolated that people are from people that are different from them, the more risk we have of this type of polarization and a divisiveness. So that's one. And that's one reason, for example, for me, although it's not my area of research, but I'm very troubled with housing segregation and school segregation, because if our children are not interacting with people that are of different socioeconomic classes, different religions, different races, then it's easy for them to be indoctrinated or fooled by propaganda that portrays whoever is different from them as evil, as bad, as violent, as dangerous. I mean, for example, the propaganda against immigrants and particularly Latin American immigrants is absolutely false. I was raised in Texas and I lived around many immigrants. I myself an immigrant, and some were documented, some were undocumented, but I can tell you one thing that was consistent across 99% of them. They were very hardworking and they came here for economic opportunity. They came here to work. They came here for better opportunities for their children. It's very difficult to leave one's home, to leave one's family, one's culture where you're familiar and where you're a member of the majority. That is not something that people desire to do. But it's a lot easier for someone to believe that immigrants are threatening and they're rapists and they're criminals and they're bad people if you don't know them, if you haven't actually lived with them and seen for yourself. No, actually, most of them work really hard. And yes, of course, some of them commit crimes, but that's the minority. And you can't take the minority and prop them up and make them suddenly represent the other 98% to 99%. So I think that's the first thing, is we really need to think about how we can each contribute to kind of desegregating our society along class and racial lines. And then the second is, I'm very troubled with, again, the rhetoric that's coming out of the White House with regard to attacks on judges, right? With regard to attacks on the media, attacks. When we have politicians, whatever political party they're associated with, start attacking the institutions that are the foundation of our society, then that can create a loss of legitimacy. And once people no longer see the courts as legitimate or judges as legitimate or the media, if they don't believe anything they read whatsoever, which then means that they have no access to information because everything is a lie as far as they're concerned, rather than having the critical thinking skills to be able to distinguish and determine and triangulate between different sources to say, okay, that is a credible source, or that's credible information, and that I don't see any support there. So what we really need to be careful of is that we don't elect politicians at local, state, or national levels that attack the institutions that are the fabric of our society. And that even includes, you know, higher education, because these are institutions that are in place that keep us keep us functional and keep us developing, the last thing we want, for example, are courts issuing decisions that no one believes are legitimate and no one adheres to, and suddenly the court system collapses, right? That's not what we want. So when I hear the president attacking judges, it really troubles me very much. It's one thing to say, I don't agree with this decision. I think the reasoning was flawed. But to accuse a judge of being biased, to accuse an entire court of having no legitimacy, of claiming everything is a witch hunt rather than saying, okay, there's a process, I don't agree with the process, I'm going to defend myself, but I will let the process go through. So that's something that I'm not pleased about at all. And I'm hoping that, it's no secret that I will not be somebody who will be supporting the current president in the reelection. And I hope that he's replaced, and whoever he's replaced with, that their rhetoric will be not as divisive, and that it will be something that will bring us more together and help us appreciate our differences rather than see our differences as a threat.
Okay, fair enough. And we'll get to that. We'll get to sort of some predictions on your part for next year. But folks, if you're just joining us right now, it's 9:55 here on the East Coast here on Blog Talk Radio. It's my pleasure to have you on the show tonight. A very interesting guest. She is the director of the Rutgers Center for Security, Race, and Rights in Newark, and also is a professor of law at Rutgers University. The great Sahar Aziz here tonight on Politically Direct. Sahar, getting back to the center, something that really, really caught my eye, obviously, as you talked about before, the three themes that the center is predicated on. Since the September 11th attacks, obviously, I know a lot of your work has been dedicated to raising awareness. Obviously, as it pertains to sort of national security laws and policies. What are some differences you saw, obviously, towards the latter end of the Bush presidency and throughout the 8 years of Barack Obama, and even now with the current, with the 45th president, what would you say is, again, as an attorney and obviously with, you know, being the director of this organization, what have been some strides that you have seen be made at the federal level, and what were some setbacks as well?
Well, on national security, there is not much of a difference in kind. There is somewhat of a difference in degree. So with Bush, well, a lot of it is self-explanatory, but I did not agree with occupying Iraq. I think the evidence was clear, and it was clear then, and it's certainly clear now that Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11, notwithstanding that he was a brutal dictator, notwithstanding that he, you know, he hurt his own people more than he hurt anyone else. And yeah, he was not somebody that anyone supported within the U.S. or within his country. However, it was internationally illegal. I mean, it was illegal from international law, but more devastatingly, it unleashed more than a decade of violence in the region and provided the political vacuum for Al-Qaeda to get stronger and eventually for ISIS to form and also get strong. And tens of, you know, millions of people died in that region in the Middle East as a result of these, of this terrorism. And we've had many people, U.S. citizens and military personnel who died, soldiers who died. And so I think that was probably the biggest mistake under his presidency and many presidencies to come in of the past. And then, you know, the other issue that continues to be a problem is the selective application of national security laws and the use of national security when it's politically expedient. So, for example, for under Bush, and Trump's tried it, but I don't think it's working because the facts are just so clear now after we've had many studies that have shown, where Bush would always scare people, we have to violate your civil liberties. We have to engage in more surveillance. We have to frisk. We have to scan your bodies at airports. We have to do secondary screening. So we have to listen in on your phone calls or at least get the metadata. So all of these, you know, legal changes, they were amendments to laws through the Patriot Act and through other laws or practices, were justified under the guise of having to keep us Americans safe from those Muslims and Arabs, right? Which, and that was fear-based, that was fear-mongering. And then eventually investigative reporters discovered that, to no surprise, the civil liberties of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Americans that were completely innocent, were violated. Their rights were violated regardless of their race or national origin, such as the NSA surveillance program, which Bush had openly denied. Obama's practices were better on some fronts, but his rhetoric was much better. I mean, what I found to be Obama's strongest point or the strengths were his rhetoric was unifying. He was somebody who was very careful about what he said. He, particularly on national security and particularly with Muslim, Arab, South Asian communities, rhetorically, he was trying to communicate to the public that, you know, these are Americans just like us, and you can be Muslim and be a loyal American, and you could be Muslim and be part of the government and be a professor and be a doctor and be a good citizen. So I think that was very important for those communities at that time because they just everything that was said about them was so negative, and it was affecting their lives on a daily basis where women were getting attacked, kids were getting bullied, people's, you know, mosques were being vandalized. So it wasn't just simply dignitary harms. I mean, they were very real material harms. But Obama didn't change much in terms of the drone program, which is highly problematic, to say it nicely, where we just, you know, we kill people by drones and we have no way of knowing if that's actually the real, if that person, there's no due process. They're extrajudicial killings. And that essentially is how we ultimately transitioned from having the military on the ground to using these drone strikes. And drone strikes increased significantly under Obama. And that was something that no one was paying attention to because his rhetoric was gentle, as we'll say. And also his immigration policies were not that great. I mean, he was just as hard on immigration as Bush was. He just focused more on those who had criminal convictions, but he actually deported more people than Bush had, and nobody really paid attention to that. And then, of course, Trump is openly anti-immigrant.
Professor, I'm really glad you said that. Professor, I'm sorry, good job. I'm really glad you said that because I've had other activists on the show, on the program. I've had I had the president from the New Jersey Alliance for Immigrant Justice. I've had other nonprofits on here. And I always sort of found it interesting that moniker, the deporter in chief, grew in popularity for Barack Obama. But it sort of takes me back again. And this is something I've talked about on this program a lot. And again, I don't know, maybe perhaps you and I differ on this. But it's a staunch reminder about media. And I'm, again, not just because I'm in higher ed, but I also am involved in media here in New Jersey, obviously under the umbrella of Insider NJ. I think what I try to do on this show every week is be fair, is to be objective and just be informative with good guests like yourself. But again, when you see that, whether it's the drone program, whether it's about immigration, I mean, let's be fair. You know, liberal media gave Obama a pass slot. He was their darling. And again, I'm not sitting here because I'm trying to defend the current president as opposed to the 44th president or the 43rd. But let's be very honest, you know, for all the heat, and I get it that the current president takes a lot of because of immigration policies and what's going on with ICE. And we'll get to that in a minute. I really want to get your thoughts on it, especially, I know, with your field of law. But it just seems that, like, you know, for all the people, I mean, at least I looked at the numbers too. Barack Obama deported more people in 8 years than I think Bush and Clinton did in 16 years together. And nobody talks about it. It seems like the liberal media gives Obama a pass. It seems like they never want to crucify him about it. And you know what? He should get some heat for that. He should get some heat for the drone program as well. But he never did. And it just seems like, again, there's that inequity within the media.
Well, I think it depends on who you're talking to. Well, the progressive communities are very critical of Obama. But I think this goes back to my point that there is no neutrality. So I don't look at the media, whether it's CNN or Fox or NPR, of course there's a bias. Everybody's got a bias. The job of the viewer is to have the critical thinking skills to be able to triangulate. Just as Fox News is biased and openly biased in favor of usually there's something that is associated with the Republican Party or certainly conservative, you know, right of center politics, I don't think MSNBC hides that it is left of center, and then CNN tries to pretend that it's in the middle, although I think it's a little bit more on the left of center. But the point is, I mean, what we try to teach our students is you shouldn't rely on only one source of media, that you should read and listen to other sources, and that some media on either the right or the left is really close to just being outright propaganda. And that just comes to the credibility of the news source, and you have to rely on journalistic ethics and the journalists themselves wanting to preserve their credibility of trying to at least base their reporting on the facts. But I also think, and so taking that into account, that media is private, which means it's funded by the private sector, whether it's advertisers or whether it's, you know, billionaires. So of course it's going to have some leanings. But keeping that in mind is, so it's going to report in ways that reflects those values. But also, it's also relative to other things. So, for example, some people who are maybe Obama supporters, and people do this with Trump now, supporters of Trump. For example, I find it baffling, confusing why many social conservatives, like devout Christians, whether they're Catholic or Protestant, I don't understand why they support Trump, because I think he's done many things and said many things that are not in compliance or adherence with, I think, traditional Christian values, especially when it comes to women and his affairs and things he said about women. And yeah, I don't think that's a secret, but they forgive him because they are looking at other things. Right? Like, well, he's doing this for us, or he's doing that for us. He put Kavanaugh on the court. So I think that happens frequently, both in media and with political groups, is that there's no perfect candidate, so people make excuses. But the job of the independents that are not associated with the party per se is to hold each person accountable and say, no, the drone strikes were bad. I mean, they were not much different. The immigration policy However, if you look at the immigration policy, the question is, look, Obama didn't separate families. He didn't separate mothers from their kids, which is what this administration is doing. And that's just outright cruel. I mean, that's beyond any basic civilized behavior to separate a mother from her child. No human being deserves that kind of treatment. So, yes, it may be that he deported more people that had criminal records, but he didn't separate, you know, mothers from their children. So a lot of it is you've got to kind of look at the big picture in terms of those policies. But just because you support a particular candidate doesn't mean you can't be critical of their policies. But
sure,
I guess I'll
absolutely.
End just with regard to Trump is that, at least on the things that I work on, Trump has been both a blessing and a curse, I think, for working on civil rights related to Muslims, Arabs, and South Asians. I mean, the curse is that he is feeding and fueling Islamophobia. His people, his team, you know, whether they're behind the scenes or formally in power, like the Stephen Millers of the world, are openly peddling Islamophobia, right? They're teaching their constituents and telling them that anytime you hear the word Sharia, you should think of the devil, right? You should think of something evil. Anytime you see a woman with hijab, you should assume that she's oppressed or that she's harboring some kind of terrorist beliefs or she's disloyal. You should believe that Muslims are trying to invade us. You should believe that they're a Trojan horse. I mean, it's dangerous, particularly for these communities, because again, it has very real cost to their daily experiences. The blessing, though, or the silver lining is because it's so blatant, and I think blatantly anti-American, because I think being that blatantly racist is not something that at least in 2019, most Americans on either side of the political spectrum that are not at the fringes find to be acceptable. Right? At the very least, they'll try to hide it. But to be that blunt has then caused many liberals and to some extent moderate conservatives, particularly moderate Christian conservatives, to wake up and realize we have an Islamophobia problem. The last 20 years has produced this monster, has produced this entrenched bigotry against this religious minority that contradicts our values. And our values are preserving religious freedom. Right? Our values are this is a country where we do not persecute religious minorities. Quite the contrary. This is where people came to flee from religious persecution in Europe. So I think his overt, explicit Islamophobia has woken many people up who otherwise were a bit complacent or in denial or because in their particular world or their daily experiences didn't see it, didn't see Islamophobia because we're only talking about, you know, 4 to 5 million people in a country of 350 million. There's not very many Muslims in the United States, although you wouldn't know that from the news coverage. It's as if, you know, they're taking over or something. So I think that has caused more public awareness. I think it's caused interest in centers like the one that I direct. And I think it's an opportunity for us to educate, again, in a way that unifies rather than divides.
Okay, fair enough. Professor, you've been an absolute pleasure tonight. Again, I know you've had a long day. Just a couple more minutes. I just want to get a couple of things in here before we end the show. But you've been great tonight being on with me for over an hour. I think we've had a great dialogue. I think you've been very informative and illuminating for our listeners tonight. And I'm thankful for your appearance. I'm hopeful that you'll want to come on again in the new year, as I always like to great guests on again repeatedly. Going into next year, Professor, I've talked to state senators, assemblymen, assemblywomen on this program, activists, journalists, and I'm trying to sort of keep it simple for our audience, but I think sometimes that's sort of the best way going into looking at elections. I would look at next year in the following. Again, it's still months until Iowa, until the first vote is cast in terms of who will be the president's opponent next November. But I look at 2020 in this manner, and I want to get your thoughts on my outlook. You know, I'm someone who did not vote for the president in 2016. As a matter of fact, I wrote myself in. Most people laugh when I tell them that, but that was just me because I wrote my name in. But going into 2020, it seems that, you know, we have a political climate where in a lot of sectors of the country, Professor, the economy is doing better for other people. Now, maybe not here in New Jersey, but I think there's a different sort of dynamic here with a legislature that just taxes us to death and a governor who's never met a tax he doesn't like, but whatever. On the national level, it seems that a lot of sectors are doing better economically. We're looking at unemployment numbers for women, for people of color that have been lower in recent years. Some might say, hey, the president's nominating judges, especially at the federal level, that aren't legislating from the bench, but just more centrist judges, maybe just the ones that are interpreting law. And for a lot of layman people in the country, that seems to be what they would like to see instead of activism on the bench. It seems like there's been some criminal justice reform that has been discussed. And on the other side, you have a party that just can't seem to get their act together. And for a lot of, you know, in New York and New Jersey and California, you know, a lot of these liberal programs or policies, yeah, this is like, you know, waffles. You know, you want to eat them in big servings, you know, whether it's driver's licenses to illegals or providing, you know, let's say health insurance to illegals in the country or other policies that might be viewed as very left. In the South and in the Midwest, people who identify as Democrats, Professor, who, let's say, are moderates or center-right or center-left, might look at what the Democratic Party is offering and say, you know what, I don't like this guy in the White House. I think he's an a-hole. I think he, you know, morally, he's just someone I don't think highly of. He lacks decorum, which I've talked about on this program. I feel the president lacks decorum a lot. I feel he lacks civility a lot. There are moments that he is not presidential. As someone who is over 40 and has seen a good amount of presidencies in his life, you know, there's a lot about the man's character that I think we can sort of just roll our eyes at and say, oh, God, help us. But if the other side is not giving us anything worthwhile, it would appear to me that in the Midwest and in the South, again, moderate Democrats might look at extreme policies in the Democratic Party, which, again, their music hears of people in California, which, as we all know, California is going to hell in a handbasket by the minute. And we see it in New York to some extent. We see the policies of Bill de Blasio, what he's done to destroy New York City. I live across from New York City. I've been going to New York since I was 16 years old. I've seen what New York has become recently under Bill de Blasio. And we're seeing what's happening in New Jersey. That's great and all. But the Democrats in the Midwest and the South may not gravitate to that. And it seems like because of that formula, the president might get another 4 years. How do you see my outlook?
Well, I disagree with a lot of what you said, but we don't have time to have a debate on every point in terms of kind of the characterization of some things. But unfortunately, our presidential elections have come down to, I believe it's 12 states. Is that the states who will determine who will win the elections, because the rest of them are either clearly blue or clearly red, and that's where they're going to be doing most of their campaigning. Mm-hmm. With regard to, I can't predict, but I will tell you just my analysis is I think that Trump can rely on 30-35% at most as a base, and I think 35% is optimistic. I think it's more 30%, which is not enough to win even the electoral vote. And the question is what's going to happen to that other 20-25%? And perhaps, well, we know he didn't win the popular vote in 2016.
That's fine.
Right, but hold on. So I think the question is, how much of that 20-25% is going to go to the other side or possibly just not show up to the polls? Because I do think there are many people who voted for Trump, even if they held their nose, and who now have been completely disillusioned by him. I think they find him to be just unacceptable as a president because of what he says and because of how he behaves and because of even his mental state. And there are many people who it's either about Trump or it's more about the presidency and trying to preserve the institution. But what percentage of those will either flip and vote for the Democrats or just not show up? Because that's another way to win. And I think that's one of the ways that he won, was that many voters just took for granted that Hillary would win, many Democratic voters, and they didn't show up to the polls. And so that was, you know, there's different ways to win. I think that for some people, even though the economy overall may be doing well, it's not necessarily doing well for particular segments of the population in particular places in the country. And that's where the Democrats, and I think that's what explains the dominant theme among the Democratic candidates, albeit there's way too many of them, but they'll eventually, I mean, eventually there it's going to be one candidate and a vice presidential candidate. But the running theme is economic equality. Because I think that is a real serious problem that both Republican and Democratic parties, I mean, both parties are to blame for producing this, but there is some very serious economic inequality in this country, and it's not sustainable if you want to stay a developed country. I mean, at some point you've got to bring people more to the middle, or else you're going to lose your middle class. And one of the biggest distinctions between thriving developed countries and those developing countries who are really struggling, and there's many differences from corruption to democratic political practices, but the other is the presence or absence of a middle class, right? And so these wealth disparities are not good for any country. And so that the question is, what about those people that have jobs that in their parents' generation you could live middle class, but now you've got to have two of those jobs just to survive, just to be above the poverty line with if you're a family of four. And I don't think that Trump's done anything for them. Right? And I think the Democrats are trying to show we can do something for you. And, you know, whether they'll deliver or not, we don't know. But that seems to be the running theme. It's not simply macroeconomic success. I think it's more of wealth equality and opportunity equality, so that people are not just certain segments are doing just fine and getting richer, and other segments are struggling more and more, not just in terms of wages, but in terms of healthcare costs, in terms of decreasing quality of education, inaccessibility to higher education, et cetera. But we'll see. I think he's lost a lot of his supporters that were not his base, though. I do think that he has a very serious reputational deficit, and I think people are very worried. I mean, the move that he made with Syria was a fatal mistake. I think when he unilaterally decided to pull out of Syria, pull the troops out, and let the Turks go in with their military was probably the biggest mistake he made in terms of angering the Pentagon and the defense contractors, and, you know, that whole base that tends to be supportive of the Republican Party, although these institutions and these political elites. And I'm not sure if they're going to make him pay through the elections, because I think now he is too volatile and too unpredictable for that very powerful stakeholder that represents kind of the Pentagon and the defense industry. So he's making a lot of mistakes.
All right. Interesting. Again, Professor, before I let you go, I want to thank you for your time. You have been, again, a wealth of information tonight. I think we've had a good dialogue. It'd be good maybe after the semester's over, we should grab lunch and talk more. I'd love to pick your brain more. I think you're a fascinating legal and political mind, and I respect it a lot. This is the part of the program where, you know, I've been the one asking questions. I'm the one trying to get a dialogue. This is where I give the floor to my guests. And if you got a question for me, if you want to pick my brain, young lady, the floor is yours.
Well, thanks very much. I guess first I'll just put a pitch for the center and say, you know, for all those who are listening, please check out our website, csrr.rutgers.edu. Check us out on Twitter at RUCSRR and also Facebook, RUCSRR, and Instagram, RutgersCSRR. So just to get that out of the way. I think my question to you is primarily, what do you think that you can do in your capacity as a professor and as someone who is attempting to influence public opinion through this podcast and a radio show? What do you think you can do to decrease this polarization that I think everybody's concerned about, regardless of their political affiliation?
Well, I'll sort of quote you from before. I think it's important to, and what I try to do with my audience every week is obviously bring on interesting guests. But what I'm really trying to promote on this program, and again, under the Insider NJ moniker and umbrella here, is just to give everybody sort of different options. You know, I want people to be able to think for themselves. You alluded to before the idea of not just relying on one media source, you know, being able to sort of read on your own, be as informed as you can. And I'm glad you pointed that out during the broadcast tonight. And I think that's what I'm trying to do on here. I mean, one of the things that, I mean, nobody else in New Jersey is doing this in the sense of a podcast of this capacity, especially with a reputable and very credible news organization like the Insider NJ. I mean, they're obviously for people in the state here, when it comes to getting their political news, I mean, our columnists are great. And I know it sounds like a shameless plug on this program, but it's, you know, I'm very fortunate to work with very outstanding journalists. And I think what I try to promote is, hey, listen, each columnist comes from a different perspective. You know, read them all, do your own homework, and kind of, you know, formulate a decision. You know, and one of the things on this show that I take a lot of pride in is just trying to have different guests on. I had very progressive guests on. I've had very conservative guests on. I've had people who are down the middle. But that's what I'm trying to do here, Professor. I'm trying to get different perspectives on it. I'll let the audience make their own decisions. I'll let the audience sort of think fully critically for themselves. I mean, I don't apologize for the fact that on this show, I think I'm someone who's center-right. But again, I'm someone who has openly embraced a lot of progressive positions. You know, I'm one of the few people that gives LGBT awareness on any podcast in the state, any sort of airtime. You know, I've done it multiple instances on this program, having Garden State Equality on, other organizations, other organizations that advocate for immigrants. So, I mean, I'm doing something that nobody else is doing in New Jersey, and I take that with a lot of pride, but I also take it with a lot of responsibility, because it's half the battle is getting credible people on, like yourself. And it makes my job easier when I'm able to get informative guests on that what they're talking about, that have a certain resume that I can say, hey, by the way, you should tune in tonight because this person has A, B, and C to offer. So that's what I'm trying to do on here. It's been working. I mean, the traffic has been great. I've been on the air since January of 2018. We're entering our second year now in January of 2020. And again, as long as I keep having wonderful guests like you, Sahar, my job's easy.
Well, thank you very much. Okay, well, I wish you the best of luck, and thank you so much for inviting me.
Absolutely. I look forward to having you back in the new year. I'll definitely be in touch with you, and keep up the good work, and we'll talk again soon. Have a great holiday season, and again, keep in touch, Professor.
All right, thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Have a good one. Take care. All right, folks, here, 10:25 on the East Coast here on Blog Talk Radio. Folks, what did you think about that episode? I think it was extremely informative. I think that the professor was, to say the very least, I think informative would be an understatement. I think she's someone that really, you know, came out here and, you know, has her position, and she defended them well. And again, folks, you decide. You know, you decide what you like to hear and what you did. And again, you know, that's one of the things about this program, folks, that, you know, what I try to do on this show here is give you different perspectives and unique guests. Again, as a reminder, check out the Rutgers Center for Security, Race, and Rights. You can check it out at www.csrr.rutgers.edu. Again, very wonderful organization at Rutgers University at the Newark campus, located at 123 Washington Street. Director Aziz mentioned, you can check out their page on Facebook, facebook.com/RUCSRR. Also, check it out again on Twitter, also on Instagram. You can also check out their content on YouTube, as well as Eventbrite, and also on LinkedIn. So, and also, listen, if you are interested in donating, especially during the holiday season, nonprofits like this center obviously rely on the generosity of strangers. Click on the website. It's right there in the very left-hand corner. Donate to CSRR. Please do that and show your support for the Rutgers Center for Security, Race, and Rights. Again, under the leadership of the director and certainly law school professor, Sahar Aziz, joining us tonight on Blog Talk Radio. Folks, again, if you missed any part of tonight's broadcast, listen, you missed a good one. Check out www.insidernj.com/podcast. And without a doubt, you will, I would argue, I think, get a really good episode tonight with Professor Aziz here tonight on Blog Talk Radio. So again, folks, www.insidernj.com/podcast. Check it out. Folks, don't forget to check out Insider NJ by going to their website, www.insidernj.com. Upper right-hand corner, you'll see the subscribe button. Click on it, and you'll be automatically enrolled free of charge in the morning intelligence briefing here with the website. And obviously, when you wake up in the morning, whether you're watching the, let's say, morning talk shows on cable news, or you're watching some of the sports programs like I do, I like to wake up and watch ESPN or Fox Sports predominantly. And, you know, as I'm checking my email, obviously it's right there waiting for the intelligence briefing. So you can't go wrong with it. Again, it's the best political coverage. And it's really the best source for politics anywhere in the state, folks. Again, check it out at www.insiderng.com. Don't forget to like them on Facebook, of course. Follow them on Twitter. And, folks, don't forget to get all of your politics every day from Insider NJ. All right, ladies and gentlemen, again, as a programming note, we will not be having a program next Thursday, obviously. It's Thanksgiving night. So in advance, I want to thank you all for supporting the program in 2019 as we enter 2020. We got a great list of guests I've been working on. One includes, as a matter of fact, the professor of political science at Montclair State University, Ms. Bridget Harrison, a friend of mine. And she's a fan of the show, obviously, working with Insider NJ as well. Happened to see her at the League of Municipalities Conference. She's just sort of, you know, reminding me that her assistant had come back to me. Certainly looking forward to having her on in January. And also some other good things I'm working on. So you have to tune in to the social media. I'm not going to give you any spoilers tonight. So again, you have to tune in and check it out. And trust me, you'll be very, very excited about the lineup I'm bringing to you in 2020, folks. A very, very important year, a very interesting year to say the very least. So we will not be having a program next Thursday, folks. We will also not be having a program the following Thursday, December the 5th. I will be attending the Hudson County Latino Foundation's Winter Gala. So it's going to be a great event. Looking forward to it. Again, as someone who was very, very fortunate to receive the Excellence in Community Service Award from the Hudson County Latino Foundation earlier this spring, I can't tell you enough, really, that attending in December is something that's important. It's a really, really great foundation. You should believe in them, as I do. And certainly look forward to, you know, seeing you there. So again, if you haven't checked it out, go to their, you know, check out their sites on social media, and look forward to seeing you there at the Winter Gala on Thursday night, December the 5th. Folks, the program will return on Thursday night, December the 12th. Got great guests coming up, just sort of finalizing some details, but you'll see it on the social media page. So folks, again, I want to thank you for your time tonight, and I can't say enough how thankful I am to all of you, my low listening audience. Without you guys and gals, this would not be possible. So without the commentary on social media, without the listens on the broadcast, because of you, this show is possible. And again, I want to give a special shout out to all of you. Thank you. God bless you all for listening, for supporting, whether it's my parents that listen in, my friends, family, everybody. I'm so thankful for all of you. You know, you, the fans, make this show possible. Again, I want to thank the Graham family for their support and their belief in this program. You know, seeing my Graham at the League of Municipalities Conference on Tuesday night, at the Insider NJ Power Party. And when he just looks at you right in the face and says, I believe in your program. We're so happy that you are part of this family. And we are so happy that you bring a certain type of credibility and distinguished journalism to our company. Listen, when you hear that from your boss, hey, you're doing something right. So again, a shout out to the Graham family, specifically my Graham running into him on Tuesday. I can't say enough about my boss, Peter Neglia. I know he's going to hate me for plugging him as much as I did tonight, but he, if you're listening tonight or if you have a chance, thank you for believing in the show, going into year two now, now in January. So, again, great boss to work for. I couldn't ask for a better one. And I love the freedom you give me on this program, and I love the support you give me. So without it, hey. And, again, I'm thankful for all my colleagues at Insider NJ. It starts with the editor-in-chief, Max Mazzaro, and so all of my great colleagues, which, you know, include columnists Al Sullivan, Fred Snowflack, Jay Lasser, and so many others. Hey, you're all doing great work. So, but without you, none of this would be possible. So I'm thankful to all of you. And again, folks, I'm thankful, as I said before, to the listening audience here, because without all of you listening, hey, the success of this program would not be possible. So again, folks, I want to wish you all a very happy Thanksgiving. Have some turkey. Enjoy the football. I'm going to be excited about watching my Dallas Cowboys against the Buffalo Bills on Thanksgiving. That's great stuff about Thanksgiving. And also enjoy the time with your family and friends, folks. Again, be careful on Wednesday night, the night before Thanksgiving Eve is always like arguably the biggest party night of the year. So be careful. Uber and Lyft everywhere. We all know municipalities like to have checkpoints out there. Don't give local municipalities and police departments a chance to take more money out of your pockets, because that's what happens at these checkpoints. I get it. Public safety is important. Yes, we get it. We don't want anyone driving around being a hazard to motorists or pedestrians. But at the same time, we all know these checkpoints can be extremely invasive and problematic. Be careful. Uber and Lyft everywhere next Wednesday night during Thanksgiving Eve. Enjoy Thanksgiving, folks. And once again, we'll come back 2 weeks from tonight on Thursday, December the 12th, live at 9 p.m. right here on Blog Talk Radio and also via insiderng.com/podcast. And again, whether it's on your morning commute, getting your workout in, walking your dog, doing laundry, homework, whatever it is, tune in, take a break, and be happy that you did. And never forget, it's real, it's here, it's politically direct. Good night, Newark, New Jersey, the home of my alma mater, Rutgers University, the Graduate School, the School of Criminal Justice, the Division of Global Affairs, and of course, the Rutgers Center for Security, Race, and Rights. Shout out to Newark, New Jersey, all the good people that are listening, and some good people I got to see last night at the Ross Baraka party during the League of Municipalities convention at the Borgata last night. Really good party. Really good to see some people. And again, thanks to every single person that came up to me during this conference. It was really humbling to see you all and to just have you come up to me and be like, hey, it's good to see you. It's good to finally meet you. And we love your show. So that tells me I'm doing something right. So again, folks, have a wonderful Thanksgiving. I will see you 2 weeks from tonight here on Blog Talk Radio, folks. And don't forget, let's keep on talking.
Get a good feeling, yeah. Oh, sometimes I get a good feeling.